A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Every day, billions of tons of rubber and steel roll over a thin film of paint that we collectively trust with our lives, and almost nobody knows what it's made of, how it's maintained, or when it's supposed to be replaced. Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about road markings, the literal paint on the road that guides everyone driving. What kind of paint actually survives being run over thousands of times a day? How do crews get those lines dead straight? How often is this stuff rated to last? And how do inspectors decide when it's time to repaint? And here's the twist. In a world where lane markings are increasingly digital, baked into navigation apps and GIS systems, are we moving toward a future where road paint is just...
That last question is the one that hooked me, because it sets up a genuine tension. On one side, autonomous vehicles are being trained to read lane lines as primary visual infrastructure. The paint matters more than ever. On the other side, high-definition digital maps are getting so good that some AVs can navigate without visible markings at all. So we're pouring billions into a physical technology that might be on the cusp of obsolescence, or might be entering its most safety-critical era. There's no consensus.
Which is exactly the kind of messy, unresolved question this show lives for. But before we can even get to the future, we need to understand what we're actually putting down on the road. And it's not what most people think. This is a $5 billion global industry hiding in plain sight, and the chemistry alone is worth the price of admission.
It really is. I went down a rabbit hole on thermoplastic chemistry this week that I'm still buzzing from. Glass beads, hydrocarbon resins, titanium dioxide. There's a whole engineered system in that white line, and the trade-offs between cost, durability, and night visibility are genuinely fascinating.
I love that you're buzzing about road paint.
Wait until I tell you about retroreflectivity measurements in millicandelas per lux per square meter. You're going to be so proud of me.
I'm already proud of you. I'm also already tired. Let's do this.
Here's the thing that surprised me when I started digging. The average driver looks at a white line and thinks paint. But what's actually on the road could be one of four completely different materials. And which one you're driving over depends on where you live, what the road budget looks like, and how cold it gets in January.
Four different materials. I would have guessed maybe two.
Most people would. You've got waterborne paint, the cheapest option, basically a souped-up latex. Lasts 6 to 12 months on a busy road before it's gone. Then there's epoxy, which is tougher but expensive and finicky to apply. Preformed tape. Think thick plastic strips with adhesive backing, used on crosswalks and high traffic intersections. And then the heavyweight champion, thermoplastic.
That's the one you were buzzing about.
It accounts for about 90% of new road markings in the US. It's a blend of hydrocarbon resins, plasticizers, titanium dioxide for the white, lead-free pigments for the yellow, and, this is the part I love, millions of tiny glass beads, tiny spheres, 100 to 800 microns across. They're partially embedded in the surface of the marking, and they're what make the line visible at night. Your headlights hit the bead, the light enters, refracts, and bounces straight back towards your eyes. That's retroreflectivity. Without the beads, a white line at night is just a dark stripe.
The line isn't just paint, it's an optical device.
That's exactly what it is. And that optical device has to survive being run over by a loaded semi about 10,000 times a day, while also being skid resistant so motorcycles don't wipe out on it in the rain, and it has to be applied at 200 degrees Celsius from a moving truck that's laying it down within millimeters of a target line. Oh, and cash-strapped municipalities need to afford it.
You've got this material that has to be simultaneously durable, visible day and night, grippy, fast to apply, and cheap. That's five competing demands.
They all fight each other. Make it more durable by adding harder resins, you might reduce skid resistance. Make it more reflective by loading it with beads, you drive up cost and potentially compromise adhesion. Every formulation is a compromise. That's why a marking that works great in Arizona. where it's hot and dry and the biggest enemy is UV degradation. Might fail in 6 months in Minnesota, where freeze-thaw cycles and snowplow blades just shred the surface.
The driver has no idea. You're rolling over a bespoke materials engineering solution calibrated to your local climate and traffic volume, and it just looks like a white line.
That's the invisible infrastructure part. And it gets even more invisible when you ask how anyone knows whether the line is still doing its job. Because here's the arc we're going to trace. We'll get into the chemistry of how this stuff actually works, then how crews apply it with laser-guided precision, then how inspectors decide when it's time to rip it up and start over, and finally, whether any of this matters in a world where your car already knows where the lane is without looking at the paint.
We're going from molecules to maintenance crews to machine vision.
The whole way through, the question underneath is, what are we actually paying for, and is it still worth it? Because that's the thing about infrastructure you can't see, you only notice it when it fails. Let's start with the chemistry, because thermoplastic is clever stuff. The backbone is a hydrocarbon resin. Think of it as a synthetic cousin to the rosin you'd get from pine trees, but engineered for thermal stability. You blend that with plasticizers to keep it flexible when it cools, titanium dioxide for brilliant white opacity, and then the glass beads get mixed in or dropped on top while it's still molten. The whole thing gets heated to about 200 degrees Celsius in a kettle on the back of a truck, and it flows out as a viscous liquid that hardens into a film 2 to 3 millimeters thick.
2 to 3 millimeters. That's thinner than my leaf medicine poultice, and I'm not entrusting that to a semi-trailer.
Yet it works because the bond isn't chemical, it's mechanical. The molten thermoplastic seeps into the pores and crevices of the asphalt, and when it solidifies, it's physically locked in place. No glue, no primer in most cases. Just heat and the natural texture of the road surface.
It's basically a hot wax seal.
That's not a bad way to think about it, and the glass beads are where it gets elegant. When your headlights hit a bead, the light enters the glass sphere, bends at the curved surface, hits the back of the bead where it's coated in the white thermoplastic, and reflects straight back toward your eyes. That's the retro in retroreflectivity. It's the same principle as a cat's eye, but distributed across millions of microscopic lenses.
That's what you measure in. I'm going to need you to say the unit again.
Millicandelas per lux per square meter. I know, it's a mouthful. But it captures exactly what matters for a given amount of light hitting the road. That's the lux, how much bounces back toward the driver. That's the millicandelas per unit area. The U.S. standard, set by the manual on uniform traffic control devices, says white lines on high-speed roads need to hit at least 150 of those units. Yellow lines, 100.
These numbers actually have teeth now.
They do, but only recently. For decades, the MUTCD standards were non-binding guidance, basically suggestions. Then, in 2012, the Federal Highway Administration issued a final rule that made retroreflectivity minimums enforceable. State DOTs and local agencies were legally required to have a management system in place to maintain night visibility. Before that, you could have a road where the lines were basically invisible after dark, and nobody was technically in violation of anything.
For most of the history of the automobile, night visibility of lane markings was just
aspirational lane lines. That's exactly right. And even now, enforcement is spotty, but we'll get to the inspection site in a bit. The point is, the standard exists, and it drove a lot of the shift toward thermoplastic, because waterborne paint just can't hold beads long enough to stay above the minimum. The beads get knocked out by traffic within months.
Which brings us to how this stuff actually gets onto the road. I've seen those crews at 3 in the morning. The truck crawling along, the weird orange glow, the line appearing behind it like magic.
The striping truck is a mobile factory. You've got a heated kettle that keeps the thermoplastic at 200 degrees, an insulated hose feeding a screed box, a flat applicator that extrudes the material onto the pavement at a controlled thickness, and immediately behind it, a bead dispenser that drops glass spheres onto the still-hot surface so they partially sink in before it cools. The whole rig moves at about 5 to 10 kilometers an hour.
Because if that line wanders by, even a few centimeters, you've got problems.
The old school method was a string line, literally a guide string stretched along the road that the operator follows by eye, still used on short jobs. But for highway work, most crews now use a GPS-guided laser reference system. A survey-grade GPS unit on the truck, accurate to within a couple of centimeters, feeds position data to a controller that adjusts the screed box laterally in real time. The spec is typically plus or minus 6 millimeters over a kilometer. That's the width of a pencil line, sustained for 1,000 meters from a moving truck laying molten plastic.
They do this at 3 in the morning because the road has to be closed.
Because thermoplastic needs about 10 to 15 minutes to cool and harden before you can drive on it. If you tried this during daytime traffic, you'd have cars smearing half-cured lines all over the place. So it's night work, lane closures, the whole thing. That's part of why the cost per linear foot is so much higher than the raw material price suggests. The logistics and labor dominate.
Which loops back to the lifespan question. If you're going to all that trouble, how long do you actually get before you have to do it again?
This is where the material choice really bites. Waterborne paint, 6 to 12 months on a high traffic road. Epoxy, 3 to 5 years, but it's expensive and the application is temperamental. Humidity and temperature have to be just right. Preformed tape, 4 to 6 years, but it costs 5 to 10 times more per linear foot than thermoplastic. And then thermoplastic itself, 2 to 4 years on a busy highway.
2 to 4 years. That's less than the average phone contract.
That's under ideal conditions. Maryland State Highway Administration did a study in 2019 and found that 23% of their thermoplastic markings failed retroreflectivity within 18 months. Not 4 years, a year and a half. They ended up reformulating their bead mix to improve retention.
You could be driving on a road where the line looks fine during the day. You can see it, it's white. But at night, it's legally substandard and you'd never know.
That's the insidious part. Daytime visibility and retroreflectivity degrade at different rates. The titanium dioxide pigment holds up reasonably well to UV and abrasion, so the line still looks white. But the glass beads get knocked out, or get coated with road grime, or get worn smooth so they stop functioning as lenses. A line can look perfectly fine at noon and be dangerously dim at midnight. And the driver has no way to tell the difference until they're in a situation where they need it.
That's the material and the application. But here's where it gets uncomfortable. How do we actually know when a line has failed? Because, as you just said, the driver doesn't.
And the answer is, often, we don't. The FHWA requires every state DOT to have a management system for pavement markings, but they don't mandate how you measure. So you get this patchwork of approaches, and the most common one is the least reliable.
Let me guess. Someone driving around and eyeballing it.
Trained raters using reference panels, essentially a laminated card with sample markings at different degradation levels. They hold it up, compare, and assign a score. It's subjective, it varies between raters, and it doesn't work at all for measuring retroreflectivity because you can't see that with the naked eye during the day.
The default inspection method literally cannot detect the most common failure mode.
And that's how most municipalities operate. The more rigorous approach is a mobile retroreflectometer, a device mounted on a survey vehicle that shines a calibrated light at the marking and measures what bounces back continuously at highway speed. It gives you a map of retroreflectivity for every meter of road, but those units cost north of $70,000, and a mid-sized city might need to spend $50,000 a year on a survey program, so most don't.
Then there's the handheld version for spot checks. Crews walk segments that have been flagged by complaints or after an accident and take point measurements. It's reactive, not proactive.
That's the real problem. The FHWA did a study in 2024. 40% of U.S. road markings on non-interstate roads were below the minimum retroreflectivity standard, and only 12% of agencies even had a formal inspection program.
So nearly 9 out of 10 agencies are basically waiting for someone to crash before they check whether the lines work.
Or waiting for a phone call. And the decision to repaint is supposed to be threshold driven. When retroreflectivity drops below that 150 millicandela number, the marking is due. But in practice, budget constraints turn it into a worst first triage. You repaint only the most degraded segments each year, and everything else slides. The gap between visibly faded and legally substandard can be 6 to 12 months, and most roads are in that gap.
We've got a system where the paint fails faster than the inspection budget can keep up. Enter the autonomous vehicle, which is supposed to solve all of this by not needing the paint at all.
That's the pitch. But the reality is messier. Most production AVs, Waymo, Cruise, Tesla's full self-driving, rely primarily on cameras and LiDAR to read lane lines in real time. They need the paint. And they struggle badly with faded markings, snow-covered roads, and construction zones where the lines are temporary or contradictory. Some researchers argue we actually need higher contrast, machine-readable markings. Now, not less marking, but better marking.
Because the computer vision system is more demanding than the human eye.
In some conditions, yes. A human can infer lane geometry from context, the edge of the pavement, the flow of other cars, the shape of the intersection. Machine learning models are getting better at that, but they're not fully reliable yet. So there's a camp that says autonomous driving makes physical markings more important, not less.
Then there's the counter camp.
High-definition maps. Waymo, for instance, builds centimeter-accurate 3D maps of every road its vehicles operate on. The vehicle fuses that with GPS, LiDAR odometry, and camera input, and it can navigate even when the paint is completely gone. They demonstrated this in a 2023 white paper. A 2-kilometer test track with all lane lines removed, navigated successfully using only HD maps and LiDAR.
2 kilometers? No paint. That sounds like case closed.
Except for one number, lateral positioning error increased by 15%. So the vehicle stayed in its lane, but it wandered more within that lane. On an empty test track, that's fine. On a highway with a semi in the next lane, that 15% might matter. And the whole system falls apart when the map is stale, if a road has been reconfigured and the map hasn't been updated, or when GPS is poor. Tunnels, urban canyons, dense tree cover.
HD maps are a backup that works until it doesn't, and paint is a backup that works until it's faded. Neither one is bulletproof.
Which is why the emerging thinking is about redundancy. The US DOT's Karma program and Europe's Sea Roads Initiative are testing roadside units that broadcast lane geometry directly to vehicles via V2X, vehicle-to-everything communication. The idea is a digital twin of the road infrastructure. The physical marking is still there, but it's supplemented by a radio signal that says the lane is here, the curve is ahead, the speed limit is this. The vehicle gets multiple independent sources of truth.
The paint becomes one layer in a stack. Not the whole stack.
That might be the most sensible outcome. Because safety-critical systems need redundancy, you don't want your car to lose lane awareness because of a single point of failure, whether that's faded paint, a stale map, or a GPS dropout. The future is probably paint plus HD maps plus V2X, not paint versus digital.
Then there's the wild stuff. I read about retroreflective tape with embedded RFID tags.
Still lab scale, but yes. The idea is that a passing vehicle reads the tag and gets not just lane position, but a unique identifier for that segment of road, which could feed into maintenance databases automatically. And there's research on smart paint containing piezoelectric sensors that generate a tiny voltage when compressed by traffic, enough to detect vehicle count, speed, even weight. The marking itself becomes a sensor network.
The Netherlands Smart Highway Project played with some of this, right?
Glow-in-the-dark markings that charge during the day and emit light at night. Those didn't last long in real conditions. The luminosity faded fast. But they also tested dynamic paint that changes color with temperature, so a snowflake symbol appears on the road when it drops below freezing. That one actually showed promise.
A road that tells you it's icy by changing the paint. That's the line becoming the sign.
It points to a future where the marking isn't just passive infrastructure. It's an active participant in the driving system. Visual and digital, physical and connected. Which is a long way from the string line and the kettle of hot plastic.
All of which raises the question. If autonomous vehicles can navigate without paint, and if HD maps are getting better every year, why are we still spending billions on thermoplastic and glass beads? The answer is more nuanced than either side of the debate admits, and it comes down to something we've been circling this whole conversation.
That's the word. In safety-critical systems, you don't bet everything on a single layer. Aircraft have triple redundant navigation for a reason. A car traveling at highway speed with a human inside, or no human inside, shouldn't be one stale map away from losing lane awareness.
The physical marking is the only layer that doesn't depend on a functioning network, a current database, or a clear view of the sky. It's just there.
Which is exactly why I think the framing of paint versus digital misses the point. The future is almost certainly paint plus HD maps plus V2X. Each layer covers the failure pattern of the others. GPS drops out in a tunnel. The paint and the map are still there. The paint is snow-covered. The map and the V2X signal still work. The map is 6 months out of date. The paint reflects the actual road as it exists today.
The role of the marking shifts. For a human driver, it's the primary visual guide, especially at night and in bad weather. For an autonomous vehicle, it becomes a redundant backup. But redundancy is exactly what you want when the cost of failure is measured in lives.
That's where the inspection gap we talked about gets alarming. Because if we're counting on physical markings as the safety net for autonomous systems, then 40% of them being below the legal minimum retroreflectivity is not just an inconvenience. It's a systemic vulnerability.
A safety net with holes in it.
The holes are invisible to the naked eye during the day. That's the part that sticks with me. A line can look perfectly serviceable at noon, white, continuous, unremarkable, and be dangerously dim at midnight. The gap between visibly faded and below legal minimum is 6 to 12 months on a typical highway. That means millions of drivers are operating on roads that are legally substandard right now, and they have no way to know.
Which brings us back to the 12%. Only 12% of agencies have a formal inspection program. The rest are essentially waiting for complaints or accidents.
That's where I think there's actually something practical a listener can do with this information. If you want better road markings in your area, and after this conversation, you might start noticing the difference. The most effective lever isn't petitioning for more repainting. It's advocating for your local DOT to adopt mobile retroreflectometer surveys.
The $50,000 solution.
About $50,000 a year for a mid-sized city to run a proper survey program. That's a rounding error in most municipal transportation budgets, but it transforms maintenance from reactive to proactive. Instead of waiting for someone to call and say, the lines on Route 12 are terrible, you have a map of every meter of road and exactly how reflective it is. You can triage based on data, not complaints.
The data exists. The technology exists. It's just a question of whether anyone bothers to collect it.
That's the frustrating part. We have mobile retroreflectometers that can measure at highway speed. We have GPS-guided striping trucks that can lay a line within 6 millimeters over a kilometer. We have thermoplastic formulations that can last 4 years if they're properly specified and applied. The engineering is solved. The gap is entirely in the inspection and maintenance budget.
Which means the variability you see when you're driving at night. One stretch of road where the lines are brilliantly bright, another where they're barely visible. That's not random chance. That's a direct reflection of your local DOT's material choices and inspection budget. Some jurisdictions are running mobile surveys and replacing based on data. Others are waiting for the phone to ring.
It's worth saying, the complaint-driven system isn't necessarily the fault of lazy engineers. Most municipal DOTs are underfunded and understaffed. They're triaging. When you have to choose between filling potholes and measuring retroreflectivity, the pothole wins every time, because drivers feel a pothole immediately. They don't notice a dim line until it's too late.
The invisible infrastructure problem in a nutshell. You only notice it when it fails, and by then someone's already in the guardrail. Where does that leave us? I want to leave you with one open question, the one that actually keeps me up, or would if I didn't nap so efficiently. As we move toward level 4 and 5 autonomy, at what point does the cost of maintaining physical markings become harder to justify? You're spending billions on thermoplastic and glass beads and night crews and mobile retroreflectometer surveys, all to maintain a visual system that the vehicles themselves increasingly don't need.
The counterweight is liability. If a fully autonomous vehicle drifts out of its lane and causes a fatality, and the investigation finds the road markings were below the legal retroreflectivity minimum, who's liable? The software developer? Or the municipality that failed to maintain the paint?
Nobody's going to want to be the first government to say, we're removing lane markings because the computers don't need them anymore. The political risk is enormous.
You end up in this strange equilibrium where the paint is technically redundant for the primary navigation system, but legally indispensable as a fallback. It's the safety net you hope nobody ever needs, but you can't be the one who took it away.
Which means we'll probably be pouring thermoplastic for decades, even if the robo-taxis don't glance at it. The paint becomes infrastructure for liability management, not navigation.
That's a fascinatingly cynical take. I think there's a more generous version, which is that redundancy in safety-critical systems isn't cynical, it's engineering discipline. The paint is the layer that works when everything else fails. No signal, no map update, no problem, it's just there.
That's the broader lesson. I think this whole topic drives home. The most invisible infrastructure is often the most engineered. We've just spent 20 minutes on a strip of paint, and we've touched on hydrocarbon chemistry, optical physics, GPS-guided application systems, retroreflectivity measurement regimes, and the failure pattern of autonomous navigation. All of that converges on a white line that you and I and millions of others drive over every day without a second thought.
Until it's gone. That's the test. You don't notice road markings until they disappear in the rain at night and suddenly you're guessing where the lane is. And in that moment, the entire edifice of chemistry and engineering and inspection, or the absence of it, becomes instantly personal.
Next time you're driving at night, look at the lines. Some will be brilliant, some will be ghosts. That difference is a story about your local DOT's budget, their material choices, and whether anyone's bothered to measure what's actually bouncing back from those glass beads. It's not random. It's a choice.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The largest known diatomaceous earth deposit in Mongolia, located in the Khentiai province, contains an estimated 45 million cubic meters of fossilized algae, which, if spread at the thickness of a typical road marking, could paint a continuous lane line from Ulaanbaatar to Lisbon and back roughly 300 times.
A very specific benchmark.
300 round trips to Lisbon. I'm not sure the thermoplastic would hold up, but the diatoms are ready.
This has been my weird prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop, and we're grateful as always to Daniel for the question. If you enjoyed this, the single best thing you can do is tell someone about the show, or leave a review wherever you listen. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.